I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, the Philadelphia Folk Song Society sets its sights on a new home. First, Delaware's Secretary of Education is resigning. Today's announcement comes amid growing criticism of his department's reform efforts. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
Secretary of Education Mark Murphy oversaw big changes in Delaware, including the rolling out of tougher standards and the introduction of a new state test. His ambitious reform agenda, however, drew criticism from teachers, principals, and parents. The teachers' union voted no confidence in the secretary earlier this year. Murphy, though, is undaunted.
And as we take on those challenges, you know, not everyone is going to be satisfied with the changes that are made and the improvements that we're seeing.
Murphy insists he was not forced out and that he's leaving to pursue other opportunities, although he did not say what exactly. Murphy officially will step down in the coming months. He will be replaced by Stephen Godowski, a former superintendent in the first state. From the Delaware desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
According to the World Meeting of Families, more than 40% of those filtering into Philadelphia for Pope Francis's visit will be coming from the city's western suburbs. But with some major highways closed for the event, many are scratching their heads about how to get around, especially for those working that weekend. Let's learn more with WHYY's Laura Benchoff.
Here's a riddle. What's bigger than the Super Bowl, but smaller than the Olympics?
You'd have to be under a rock not to know that the Pope is coming.
That's John Collins, the director of operations for City Avenue Special Services District, a nonprofit that works with businesses along Route 1. A portion of that roadway, which separates Philadelphia from Montgomery County, will be shut down when the Pope's in town. Collins says that poses a challenge to retailers hoping to cash in on foot traffic near St. Charles Borromeo Seminary.
And they're concerned about, you know, how do I get my people to work? How am I going to get my supplies and all that kind of stuff?
Those people are reverse commuters, people who leave the city's core to work in the suburbs. Rob Henry is executive director of the Greater Valley Forge Transportation Management Association. His organization is toying with a number of solutions for getting reverse commuters out of Philadelphia. One option, he says, is private shuttles.
You know, like a large retail establishment like King of Prussia Mall, in the past they have, for example, during SEPTA strikes, they've actually paid for shuttle service.
But that could cost $3,000 per van per day. And around 20% of mall employees use SEPTA to get to work. Other options include carpooling and even biking. But with the Schuylkill Expressway eastbound closed from the Blue Route all the way to I-95, Collins says remaining highways will likely be jammed up.
If you're closing that section of the expressway and City Avenue, I think all roads in between are going to be difficult to navigate.
That's why he says he'll bring his bike, just in case. A spokeswoman for SEPTA says the transit authority is waiting to finish its latest papal ticket lottery before addressing transit questions for reverse commuters. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benchoff.
Fainting or getting woozy is a pretty common reaction to seeing blood or a syringe. It happened recently to WHYY's Carolyn Beeler for the first time, and as a science reporter, she tried to figure out why.
So it turns out this whole process starts when that needle or the sight of blood triggers the classic fight or flight response. Your adrenaline spikes, you get a little bit jittery, your eyes widen, and your pulse quickens. Thomas Jefferson University cardiologist Dan Frisch explains why we have this reaction to something surprising or startling.
So the classic example would be the tiger chasing you. Perhaps if you're a caveman, that'll get your blood pressure up, that'll get your heart rate going, and you'll run pretty fast and be hyper aware of your surroundings.
This revving up is what's called your sympathetic nervous system kicking into gear. After the initial threat has passed, the opposite system, the parasympathetic nervous system, is designed to take over. It chills your body out by lowering blood pressure and heart rate.
Say you've captured that tiger and made it into a meal. At the conclusion of your meal, that feeling of being a little bit sedated or drowsy, that's mediated more by the parasympathetic nervous system.
These two reactions are supposed to balance each other out. But when you feel faint or woozy, it's because this rest and digest response overpowers that first fight or flight response. Your blood pressure and heart rate drop too low, and not enough oxygen gets to your brain, so it starts to shut down. Part of the reason we faint when this happens is because we walk on two legs.
We are vertical creatures, so we are always battling gravity to get blood up from our heart to our brains.
That's Dr. Behzad Pavri, another Jefferson heart doctor. He says this upright posture is important, but it's not the whole story.
If you're talking about head being above the heart, think of the giraffe. It ought to be fainting all the time, but it doesn't. This is a problem that is unique to the human species.
It's a unique problem because of our unique physiology. Pavri gives three examples.
Number one, we are the species with the greatest northbound load. We have to push one-fifth of our cardiac output up to our big oxygen-requiring brains. Number two, we have the most powerful lower extremities on the planet.
Our legs can hold a lot of blood. So when our blood vessels dilate in this rest and digest response, a lot of it pools there in our legs. Reason number three, we humans can lock our knees, which prevents blood from moving back upward. Now, passing out just when you or a loved one is hurt and bleeding or in seeming danger from a scary needle appears counterintuitive from an evolutionary perspective. But Pavri says it may actually have helped our ancestors.
When this happens to a person, they look like they died. They are limp and unconscious on the floor, immobile. You can imagine how an aggressor might think the person's dead and walk away.
The fainting reaction could also protect the heart during stressful situations. Or it could keep you from bleeding out if, say, that tiger you were chasing for dinner bit off your arm.
This reflex kicks in at the sight of blood or with pain. I faint, but while my blood pressure is low, it gives the bleeding limb a chance to clot.
Why we often have this reaction when we see others bleeding or getting stuck with a needle, now that is an open question. It could just be that a needle is a needle no matter where it's aimed. Or it could be a sign of a kind of unconscious empathy pre-programmed into all of us humans. I'm Carolyn Buehler, WHYY News.
Turning to this evening's headlines, a proposed natural gas pipeline through the Pinelands in New South Jersey seems to have much better odds of winning approval after action by the executive director of the Pinelands Commission. Nancy Wittenberg announced today that the controversial proposal from South Jersey Gas is not subject to approval by the full commission. That will fall instead just to Wittenberg and the State Board of Public Utilities. She also announced that the application from South Jersey Gas is now complete and ready for consideration. Environmental groups are furious and charge reclassifying the pipeline as a private development is illegal. The Pinelands Commission previously deadlocked on the proposal, and if built, it would help convert a coal-fired power plant in Cape May County to run on natural gas. The Federal Emergency Management Agency says it strongly encourages anyone seeking Superstorm Sandy-related payment reviews to submit them by September 15th, though it will consider all requests that come in. A spokesperson said today that the agency will consider requests even if they come in after that September 15th deadline. FEMA claims it sent direct mail to some 142,000 policyholders and has worked with members of Congress and advocacy groups to encourage anyone who thinks they were underpaid to have their claims reviewed. Sunshine, 85 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:15. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clear skies overnight, low 65 degrees, and then a spate of sunny days tomorrow right through Tuesday. Saturday's high around 90, high Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday in the low 90s. You're listening to WHYY. Still ahead, the group generating buzz around Philadelphia's waterfront says it's a surprisingly easy feat to accomplish.
Take a look around this park. We're using old cargo containers, which honestly aren't that expensive to procure. This space is populated by trees and tree stumps and wood chips.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Devereaux, backed by more than 100 years of service to individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and half a century of working directly with children and adults with autism, now provides autism diagnoses for children. Devereaux offers timely appointments in as little as 4 weeks and uses the ADOS-2, the latest of autism assessments. For more information or to request an appointment, devereaux.org. Devereaux is proud to support WHYY.
I listen to Bullseye to be cooler and more cultured than the people who don't know about Bullseye yet. Of course, then I tell them about Bullseye, so it doesn't usually work for very long.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Keegan-Michael Key from the comedy show Key & Peele and Titus Burgess from The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Next time on The World, growing up in a closed-off Hasidic community.
I did not get a proper English education. We pretty much did alphabets, A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Lipa Schmelzer sent himself to college, even though he'd never been to high school. Along the way, he became a Hasidic pop star. His music and his story on The World.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newswork Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. 80 years ago today, then-President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Social Security Retirement Plan into law. The entitlement plan has benefited millions, but some wonder how secure it will be going into the future. Let's put that hunch to Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, to what extent are especially younger Americans worried about whether Social Security will be there for them at retirement age?
There is quite a bit of worry, and this is an important consideration because we ask retirees, those that are currently retired, how much do you depend on a variety of sources of income, and Social Security is by far at the top of the list. So a lot of Americans currently depend on Social Security, but in answer to your question, when we ask Americans who aren't retired, do you think that you will get your Social Security benefits when you do retire? Half say no. They're skeptical or cynical that they won't get them. You mentioned young people. When we look at those that are under 50, it's only down to about a third who think they're going to get their benefits. So there's a lot of deep-seated skepticism that this program, which has worked wonderfully well to many degrees to this point, is going to be there when young people come to age 62, 66, 70, whatever it is, and start to get their benefits.
Is it all or none, or are folks wondering if it'll just be rolled back a bit?
Well, that's a good question. And we do know when you look at the Social Security Administration's own calculations, they say they will have to start reducing benefits in 2034. I think that's the latest year they calculate when the trust fund begins to run out of money. But when we asked the question, we just said, do you think you'll get benefits or not? And 51% said no. They don't think they'll get benefits.
Frank, this August 14th is also notable in that the U.S. flag is flying at the U.S. Embassy in Havana for the first time since 1961. Does that meet with majority approval in the United States?
Oh, it does, and it always has. In fact, we asked that question about reestablishing U.S. diplomatic relations with Cuba back in 1974. Now, I say always has, so we didn't ask it back at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis in this way. But going all the way back to the 70s, we had 63% of Americans who said, yes, we should reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba. We've asked it off and on over the years since, and almost always we get majority support. Now, we just ask it this year, and we're up to 59-60% of Americans who say yes, they like the idea. So I think what's happening there today, what did happen there today in Havana today, is a good thing, according to the majority of Americans.
John Kerry was on hand today. What do Americans think of him?
Well, his approval rating on a relative basis, not as good as other Secretary of States. He has averaged 47% favorable rating. So far, since he's been Secretary of State, we tracked him way back when he was running for president as well, back in 2004. But since he's been Secretary of State, he's averaged 47. But let me give you some examples. Hillary Clinton averaged 64 favorable rating while she was Secretary of State. Condoleezza Rice averaged 60. Colin Powell averaged 86% favorable rating when he was Secretary of State. A lot of that came after 9/11 when everybody was getting good ratings. And Madeleine Albright is another example, averaged 62% when she was Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. So I would say on a relative basis, Kerry's not doing as well in the eyes of the public, at least in terms of his overall image, as other recent secretaries of state.
You know, with the clamor over Hillary Clinton and the email debacle, some say it opens up the Democratic field, and even John Kerry's name is being whispered as a potential candidate. What does that field look like now?
Yeah, we hear John Kerry now. The rumor du jour this week, as you know, Dave, has been Al Gore. Could he come out of political retirement and run? And, of course, we hear a lot about Joe Biden. But actually, we don't see any evidence in our tracking data, and we're tracking her image nightly, that Hillary Clinton's image has cratered in any way whatsoever. Among Democrats, it's 77% favorable, 18% unfavorable. And I look back to see what it was, for example, last month, and it was almost exactly the same. So clearly, something could change, but at the moment, we're not seeing it in the data, at least to this point.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. When cities reimagine their waterfronts, they often go for big buck projects like an aquarium, a casino, a sports venue, or a string of hotels. The nonprofit that manages one of Philadelphia's waterfronts is trying something different. It's starting small and cheap. Keystone Crossroads reporter Marielle Segarra has more.
The Delaware River Waterfront Corporation is great at bargain hunting. Ask Jody Milkman. She's DRWC's Vice President of Communications and Programming. She's walking through the group's latest project, a park with a roller skating rink and a boat-themed lodge. It's called Blue Cross River Rink Summerfest after the rink's sponsor.
Take a look around this park. We're using old cargo containers, which honestly aren't that expensive to procure. This space is populated by trees and tree stumps and wood chips.
Summerfest is one of several low-cost, seasonal parks that are bringing hundreds of thousands of people to a stretch of the Delaware River waterfront. Another is Winterfest, a wintertime ice rink and lodge in this very spot. And there's also Spruce Street Harbor Park, a summertime park a couple blocks away that's filled with hammocks, arcade games, and food and beer vendors. Each park costs less than $1 million to build. Visitors don't seem to mind or even realize these waterfront parks were made on the cheap. Kaya Simonson is laying in one of the free hammocks at Spruce Street Harbor Park. She says the park actually feels kind of fancy to her.
It seems like a place where you might have to pay to get in, but it's free and everyone can access it.
DRWC hasn't gathered the stats, but it's obvious from visiting that the parks draw a diverse crowd. That's what Lou Valenti noticed. He works on park-related projects for the state of New Jersey, and he visited Spruce Street last year for inspiration.
Folks looked like they were investment bankers. Folks looked like they were walking through with their families, young people on skateboards.
And people of various races and ethnicities. When Spruce Street opened last year, DRWC hoped to bring in 100,000 visitors over a few months. 500,000 people showed up. The park has been even more popular this season. Winterfest has done well, too. Attendance has been spotty at the Summerfest roller rink. But one thing is certain. These parks are changing the way some Philadelphians feel about their waterfront. Adrian Hoppel lives in the city and brought his family to Spruce Street for the first time this summer. His kids loved the hammocks and the giant chess game. For decades, the city tried and failed to bring big developers and mega projects to this stretch of the Delaware. Hoppel remembers that time.
I feel like the city's been trying to do something with it my entire life, and this is some of the first stuff that seems to have worked.
DRWC wants to build public spaces people like Hoppel and his family can enjoy. But at the same time, these parks are not its end goal. Long term, the group wants to build a waterfront that's self-sustaining and permanent, not something that pops up and closes every season. So DRWC is using the parks to drum up support for the city's not-so-low-cost $250 million waterfront master plan. That calls for covering parts of the highway that cuts people off from the waterfront, among other things. The group's CEO, Tom Corcoran, says the parks are a first step, a way to get people used to coming to the river.
And then once they do, and the time comes for the public sector to invest more, you have a built-in political support system of people who want to see great things happen on their waterfront.
The group also hopes the foot traffic will show developers that it's worth building on the Delaware. They would bring tax dollars, jobs, and housing to the city. There's a long way to go before DRWC can say its mission is complete. But the success of the parks shows it's possible to accomplish a lot on a city's waterfront with only a little funding. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station initiative. To see more in our Urban Waterfront series, including an interactive map, check out keystonecrossroads.org/waterfronts. At the annual Philadelphia Folk Festival this weekend, Arlo Guthrie will celebrate the 50th anniversary of his famous song, Alice's Restaurant. At the same time, the festival has announced big plans for the future. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on a new home for folk music.
On Thursday, the first day of the festival, the Philadelphia Folk Song Society announced it will be buying an old Lutheran church in Roxborough and converting it into a permanent performance space. For 53 years, the Society has run the festival, and aside from the long weekend at the old pool farm in Schwanksville, it has never had its own venue. The Society will buy Grace Evangelical. It's a decommissioned Lutheran church built in 1910 at Roxborough and Ridge Avenues. Society Director Justin Nordell says most recently it was being used as a medical imaging clinic.
The MRI facility completely left the chapel intact. They did nothing to it. They used the other part of the building. So we've got a full chapel with a full pipe organ that still works. I was just playing with it on Tuesday.
The church is twice the size of the Society's current home in Mount Airy, and it will house its entire operation, offices, classrooms, a library of archival recordings, and a performance venue that, with some renovations, could accommodate about 200 people. The purchase price is $1.2 million. To pay for it, Nordell has launched a five-year capital campaign.
Capital campaign dollars are very separate from festival dollars. Any capital campaign investments actually need to come directly in as such for, you know, legal purposes.
The 35,000 people expected to attend the festival this year will be asked to donate to that capital campaign on top of their ticket price. Nordell says a substantial amount has already been raised. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Alex Lewis and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks and Adam Staniszewski. Joyce Lieberman is our radio engineering supervisor. Chris Sotulo is WHYY's vice president of news and civic dialogue. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. This fall, continuing education at PAFA is partnering with Arts Philadelphia to offer art classes for those suffering from dementia and memory loss and their caregivers. Students can experience how art making can unlock creativity, create new memories, and strengthen relationships with a new sense of community. Includes facilitated discussions in the PAFA Museum. More at 215-972-7632 or pafa.edu/ce.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Felicia Day started out acting on TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Supernatural. Then she found her stride by infiltrating online geek culture. Next time on Q, she talks about how the digital world helped her thrive. That's coming up on Q from PRI, talking about Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.